We now broadcast the 25th episode or chapter in our ongoing historical series, where we look at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican throughout the centuries. The programme is written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Today's episode takes us back to the second half of the 15th century, as the Renaissance penetrated more deeply into daily life, and we hear about how papal government was reorganised during this period.
Chapter 25, Change and Renewal.
The third quarter of the 15th century is studded with the birth dates of a galaxy of star names, some famous, some infamous.
Christopher Columbus.
Lorenzo the Magnificent.
Savonarola.
Leonardo da Vinci.
Erasmus.
Machiavelli.
Copernicus, and many more.
The middle of the century saw the beginning of the Wars of the Roses in England and the emergence of Warwick the Kingmaker.
In navigation, the Venetian sailor Cadamosto discovered the Cape Verde Islands and explored the rivers of Senegal and Gambia.
A German astronomer named Regiomontanus began a nautical almanac in 1474, in which he described the method of finding longitude by using lunar distances.
In 1469, the marriage of Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon achieved a united Spain. But meanwhile, in 1478, the Spanish Inquisition had been established.
As the century wore on, the Renaissance penetrated more and more deeply into daily life. The classical ideal, the complete, versatile man, had become a reality.
With it came a rehabilitation of marriage and a healthier, more balanced attitude towards women.
In life, as in art, beauty was once more appreciated. While in literature, humour made its reappearance after more than 1,000 years of solemn writing.
Meanwhile, in Rome, the papacy was acquiring a new, more streamlined image.
With the reconstruction of the Vatican, begun under Nicholas V, a change took place in the style and principles of papal government. As the power of secular rulers over their national churches increased, they exploited the Pope's need for allies against the councils, and a series of concordats followed with individual princes.
These concordats, in theory, ensured the Pope's supremacy over the councils, but it was the princes who reaped the benefits. Now the most important decisions affecting church government were made by diplomatic machinery. The papacy had to find new organs of government, develop new institutions, and streamline the old. Changes began, as always, with the Curia.
Since the 12th century, the Chancery had been one of the main vehicles of papal government. Now it became an office for routine business, while the more responsible work passed to new offices, whose connection with the Pope was more direct and personal.
The Signatura was instituted at this time, an office which examined all requests for concessions made to the Pope. During Sixtus IV's pontificate, it became a fixed department with two divisions. Under Sixtus also, the Datary was organised as an independent financial department.
Diplomacy was firmly established with the organisation of papal nuncios, who took the place of the collectors or tax gatherers, who'd represented the Pope since the early 14th century. From the time of Sixtus IV, permanent nuncios appeared, directly responsible to the Secretary of State, who gave them their orders and to whom they sent their reports.
Since the return of the popes from Avignon and the end of the Great Schism, Rome was at last beginning to recover some of her lost dignity. Now that the popes were installed in the Vatican Palace, the area lying between the Vatican and the Commune on the Capitoline Hill took on an importance it had never known before.
From the mid-15th century onwards, successive popes widened and improved the two great thoroughfares, the Via Papalis, or Papal Way, and the Via Peregrinorum, or Pilgrim's Way, and the streets surrounding them. And in preparation for the Holy Year of 1475, Pope Sixtus IV built a bridge, still known today as Ponte Sisto, connecting the area with Trastevere, that part of Rome which most belongs to the Romans.
But although the times were more tranquil for the church than the previous century, the election of a pope was still an occasion for heated argument and personal conflicts. Only now the ferment was internal.
From 1458 to 1464, the throne of Peter was occupied by a man who entered the priesthood when he was over 40 and was known as a famous humanist. Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, who took the name of Pius II, was a cultivated man of the world who wrote profusely and kept an entertaining diary.
Here is his account of the intrigues preceding his election.
Lots of little groups were formed. Those who enjoyed most authority in the sacred college and who possessed the greatest wealth called the others to them and asked for the pontificate, either for themselves or for their friends. They begged, they promised, they threatened. Nor was there any lack of those who, quite shamelessly and abandoning every feeling of modesty, spoke in favour of themselves, claiming the papal throne. Each one, in long speeches, boasted of his own qualities. The feeling of rivalry was extraordinary, and great was the zeal of everyone. For them the day passed without rest, and the night without sleep. The Cardinal of Rouen, in the hopes of winning votes for himself, promised to distribute ecclesiastical benefices. Many were won over by his promises and allowed themselves to be drawn like flies in their greed. Christ's garment was sold without Christ.
The programme was written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.